This program is brought to you by the Genesis Communications Network, a world leader in talk radio since 1998. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Prices plunging toward $3 a gallon. Wall Street had a good day from inflation fears being ebbed in a different direction and a year-end rally, plus word that the Feds weren't going to raise the interest rate again at a crazy high level. It would be a lot smaller. So stock surging is good news, whether you're in the middle of the game or not. Hey, everybody. Kate Delaney, welcome to the show. It is good to hear anything that drives down the cost of what we all will feel when we go to grocery stores, etc., and in the middle of a holiday, right? Especially, but also getting ready to turn the corner to go into 2023. It also looks like that rail strike might be averted, but I always say don't count your chickens before they're hatched, so we'll see. There still is some time before December 9th when we'll know for sure whether it's completely settled or not. But stocks did surge. The Dow Jones was more than 20% above its September low, and that's because partially the Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, he made some comments that there were signs of cooling U.S. inflation, and so now there's hopes that the central bank is going to become less aggressive on the interest rate hikes, because that's really shaken up real estate, for example, people buying homes, looking at the mortgage rates, where the mortgage rates became so much higher because of that. So to me, that maybe that means finally it's working. That's the good news there. And, of course, gas prices, we all feel that. If you're traveling to and from, unless you're riding a bike or somehow carpooling or staying at home and not really going too much out of your territory, your neighborhood, to do the things that you have to do. But the cost of gasoline is falling really, really fast. And that's unexpected, kind of, because there were talks that it was going to drop a little bit. But to say that it could drop below $3 by Christmas, that is serious relief. AAA is saying that a price of a gallon of regular gas, the average, because it could be even be less in some places, and of course in some places it's going to be more, but $3.50, that is great news. And I know that'll help people, because when you got to go, you got to go. When you got to travel by car, you got to travel by car. And a lot of people do not have those alternatives to think of clever ways to get around extremely high gasoline. So that is great news. Great, great news. In the meantime, a lot of what's being talked about, I think, in this country is, you know, is that is exactly what's happening with the economy and what's happening heading into 2023. Throughout this month, we're going to go through the best of the best of the stories of 2022 and then do some predictions as we head into 2023. I could have told you this prediction. The Uvalde survivors have finally filed that class action lawsuit. They're seeking $27 billion from law enforcement entities, school districts, and others. So this was going to happen, especially with so much video that's out there and so much of that investigative report that showed there was too much time where kids were in a classroom, where officers waited 77 minutes after the shooter entered two adjoining classrooms before storming in and killing the gunman, the 18-year-old. And you had 376 law enforcement types from multiple agencies that responded to the massacre, the second deadliest shooting on a K-12 school in the U.S. And the parents and the families are heartbroken, ripped apart, and furious. And the way you go about this is the legal route to go after them through through the court. So this was something that was inevitable, and this was one of the big stories, sad stories of 2022, is what happened afterwards, the details, and just the shock of innocents losing their life again in a classroom where they should feel safe. They should be able to go to school and learn and not go to school and never come back again, right? Another thing that is on the brighter side, I'll call it, because I, like many of you, I look up. I'm looking for the stars, right? I'm looking for the stars every night when I walk the dog. I'm looking for sometimes these amazing things that I see, like a shooting star. There was an incredibly bright flash that, and this takes, I was in Texas then, and it takes us all the way back to February. And there was this bright flash that people were talking about that happened in February, and it was the result of a star straying too close to a supermassive black hole where it was ripped to shreds. But that is a rare cosmic event that happens 8.5 billion light years away from Earth when the universe was just a third of its current age, and it's created all these questions for us, right? And it's fascinating that that's what it was, these bright lights, right? You know, the whole idea of the black hole, and astronomers believe that when the black hole gobbled up a star, it releases a massive amount of energy and sends a jet of material streaking across space at near the speed of light. So what will we learn because of that incident that happened back in February? And a lot of the astronomers and people that work on these kinds of things are saying that it's interesting to look at disruptive events from distant black holes. So I'll be curious about that, and we're going to have an astronomer on the show to talk about it. If you've ever been to an observatory, it's amazing. I mean, I've been to observatories all over the country and seen some things that don't even look real to me. When I'm looking in these powerful, you know, telescopes, I'm just stunned by the beauty that we see. Somebody told me one time, and I think I was in Ireland, somebody said this to me, you know, when you know what you want to do? He said, you know what you're going to do, Les, when you want to really know about history, you want to know about life? Look up. And there is something to that. I always look at the stars, and you never know what you're going to see. And I think when that happened in February, people had no idea what it was, and they wanted to know, what does that mean? What is that flash? What, you know, what is it? What is it? Something we do not want to see really explode in a different way here in the United States is COVID-19, the different variations. We know that this is something we had to live with, and we also know what happened during the pandemic. Well, China, it's interesting what's going on in China. They're talking about zero COVID, and now there have been all these protests. There's been protesters clashing with police, and it's all over the COVID-19 containment measures. They're talking about that it's not a human-centered response. There have been these lockdowns in some of these really big districts that have remained as high designated areas for COVID-19. Some places, they look like ghost towns. So lots of protests. Meet you on the flip side.
If you're like most Americans, you can see things are out of control. Global problems have local consequences, too many of them. And if the next news headline spins us into chaos, you'd better be ready. Grocery store supply chains are only as strong as their weakest link. Don't wait for them to break. Today's the day to secure emergency food for everyone in your family. My Patriot Supply is America's largest preparedness company. Our specially packaged and delicious food stays fresh for up to 25 years in storage. It'll be there when you need it. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com and pick up several emergency food kits. There are a dozen different sizes that average over 2,000 calories per day. As we all know, calories equals energy equals survival. And as you'd expect from a true preparedness company, our food kits are in stock and ship quickly. Those who know what's coming are preparing today. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com. MyPatriotSupply.com.
First, we decide where we want to go. Then we need to know the best way to get there. Hi, my name's Adam Baratta. I'm the owner of Advantage Gold. We're the highest rated precious metals firm in the country. We teach people how to own physical gold and silver. Now, we've won the Best of TrustLink Award 4 years in a row because we educate our clients on how to buy gold and silver the right way. We don't pay celebrity spokespeople millions of dollars. We'd rather pass that value on to you. Call 800-900-8000 and speak with one of our experts. We'll send you a free gold kit along with my latest number one national best-selling book, The Great Devaluation. Call 800-900-8000. That's 800-900-8000. Get the best information, the best process, the best service, the best value. Call Advantage Gold at 800-900-8000. Call 800-900-8000.
Advantage Gold is not an investment advisor or a tax advisor. Consult with your financial advisor before investing.
Call 800-900-8000.
Hey guys, why settle for poor quality powdery arco that's sold by stores and online resellers when you can get Tejibo Tea Club's original pure powdery arco super tea at drinksupertea.com or 818-965-9113. The Tejibo Tea Club's original pure powdery arco super tea is only available at drinksupertea.com. 818-965-9113. 818-965-9113. That's drinksupertea.com.
Ever feel completely down on your luck, whether it's your career or just your life? Do you look at other people and wonder, why them, not me? I'm Kate Delaney. I did it. I admit it. I've learned some valuable and priceless lessons from some of the rock stars I've interviewed over the years, like Sir Richard Branson or the late, great John Madden, and I want to share them. Want to laugh? Want to learn? Want more out of life? Then pick up a copy of my book, Heal Your Own Destiny, Increase Your Odds, Win Big, and Become Extraordinary. Get it on Amazon today.
Welcome Ellis Sandlin to the show. He has such an interesting background, an interesting life, the things that he's done and accomplished. And now the latest thing, of course, a children's book. And I love tigers, so this really struck me. Ravi the Amber-Eyed Tiger. And his partner, his wife, Ann Kumans, also is part of this Ann and Ellis a dynamic duo. But we're pleased to have Ellis with us. Ellis, thanks for popping on.
My pleasure, Kate.
First of all, let's talk about you. Let's talk about what happened with you. You were born and raised in Detroit, Michigan. You were born with cataracts in the lens of each
eye.
Yeah. And what does that mean? I mean, you went to Braille school.
What happened? Well, not Braille school, but I went to regular school with a Braille class, and, you know, we attend classes with sighted children. Of course, I was just a small, I started school when I was 4 years old. I had my first eye operation when I was four, got some sight. And then that year I started school, and for the first 3 years I was in Braille, and then, Braille class, and then, 2 years later in 46, or 1940, or 3 years later in 40, see, let me straight. 1945 was when I had my first operation. I was 4 years old. And then 2 years later, in 1947, in May of that year, I had my second eye operation, which helped my sight pretty good for the next 7 years.
And so then there was a series of things that continued to happen. You didn't let any of that slow you down, no matter what was going on.
Oh, no.
I mean, you were 17, you were playing the guitar, you were singing, you were with your father at benefits, all of that, and played with different bands. So nothing stopped you, whatever was going on with your sight.
No, it didn't.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'll tell you, and in 1949, September 49, my sight was good. So that year I started in a sight-saving class at Parker Elementary School in Detroit, and I went there until early February of 54 when I graduated into Hunter Junior High for a couple years. And then my last year in sight-saving, when my eyes started to go bad, I went to Barber Intermediate School over on the east side of Detroit. And after that year, I had to go back to Braille. I took home teaching in Braille in the fall of 56. And in February of 1957, I got into the Braille room at Durfee Junior High School. And I finished the last two semesters there. You know, I attended classes with regular sighted children. And, you know, I took notes and had people redo us and everything. And then in February of 1958, me and my friend Ed Buckman graduated together into Pershing High School in a Braille room there, and same thing, attended class with regular sighted children, and graduated in June of 1961 from Pershing High School.
Wow. So let's fast forward, and we want people to know about the your book. Tell me about your book and how this came about.
Well, many years, I've always been fascinated with tigers and lions and other wild animals as well. And when I was able to see, tigers always been one of my most favorite because of their beautiful color. Especially those with a pretty orange coat and black stripes and white undersides and everything. And I just always somehow been fascinated with lions and leopards and all the other as well. And one time years ago, just for my own pleasure, I kind of thought up that story about Ravi, the Amurai tiger, and then when I told Ann that, well, we added more things to it and everything, and now I got this book written. So I thought I'd be glad to share that with you, Kate.
Yes, and you heard me say that I love tigers, too, as well. So
yes,
tell us the story, because people are going to be fascinated by this. What's the story about? What happens to this tiger?
Well, start out with, you know, he was one of three cubs born to a mother tigress, and naturally tigers stay with their mother the first 2 years of their lives before going on their own, and because that time the mother teaches them the skills of hunting and stuff they need to know to survive. And out of these three, there's two females and one male, and I chose a male, and I gave him the name of Ravi, and I named him because after an Indian classical sitarist named Ravi Shankar. I don't know if you heard of him or not.
Yes, famous. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I named him after Ravi Shankar. And what happened was, when he left his mother, he started out living on his own and became a pretty good, skillful hunter, thanks to his mother's training and everything. And I'm sure his other two siblings did the same thing. And Ravi was out living a pretty good life for a while, successfully hunting his kills and everything. Then one day he came too close to an Indian village, and one villager saw him and took a shot at him, and bullet grazed his shoulder. It didn't wound him bad, just grazed his shoulder. And then he made it back into the jungle to his lair or wherever. And then Christmas Eve night, he was going to, of course, he didn't know it was Christmas Eve, but he was going to go, because of the wound, it made him angry, and he developed a hate toward man. He was going to turn man-killer because of it. But as he was on his way to the village that Christmas Eve night, he came to a jungle clearing, and, you know, his eyes were glowing amber color from his raging anger and everything. And he stopped, and all of a sudden he heard a noise he never never recall hearing before. It was sleigh bell, and looked up, and there was Santa Claus. And he, for a second, there was just something about that he kind of forgot his vengeance toward man and looked on this jovial elf Santa Claus, and Santa Claus saw his two amber eyes and asked, because it was a dark night, there was no moon, so he asked Robbie to guide him to the nearby village so he could deliver his gifts there to the children. So Ravi did, and it became pretty much a well-loved tiger after that. So that's basically what the story's about.
What do you hope children take away from being read this book or read this book? What do you hope they take away from it?
Take away from it?
Yeah, what do you want them to feel? Do you want them to feel like, wow, this is an interesting, inspiring story, this is a fun story?
Yes, I would like to. And fun and inspiring story. Yes, I would like it to be that way.
Yeah, and there's something about, you know, the tiger becomes friends with this young orphan boy, and their friendship grows.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because what started that was when Robbie, you know, he was afraid to come out when Santa Claus pointed to the villagers, how he got to the village. When he did, the villagers took a liking to him, and this little orphan boy especially. And what they did, Harvey's attitude toward man because of that, you know, the birth of Christ, and on the story goes with this, him and this orphan boy became good friends, and that's basically what the story's about, Kate.
Yeah, so again, Ravi the Amber-Eyed Tiger by Ann and Ellis. Of course, you can get it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, wherever great books are sold. Will we have another story in the future, maybe, of the tiger?
We're going to try to work on one in the future, yes. A sequel to it, yes.
Yeah, can't wait to see what happens there. Ellis, it's been a delight to have you on the show. Thank you for coming on.
My pleasure, Kate, and nice meeting you, and have yourself a wonderful day.
You too. I love his spirit. Again, as I said at the top of this, not letting anything keep him down. Speaking of not being kept down, in her day she was known for the beautiful words that she wrote, but Christine McVie, dead at 79, and lots of Twitter accounts, not Twitter accounts, but accounts of Christine McVie and her impact on the music world have been out there on Twitter and social media, etc. And she was the co-lead vocalist and keyboardist of Fleetwood Mac. She wrote so many of the popular, you know, songs of Fleetwood Mac. Got a Hold on Me would be one. Songbird was one of those too as well. Don't Stop. There's so many of them, but she had a brief illness and died in England at the age of 79. And she was very popular in her time with Fleetwood Mac. So bandmates, etc., like I said, are expressing their words over what her impact was to the music business and to that band. And she was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame along with the other Fleetwood Mac members in 1998. And the impact of the music, of course, is still being felt because a lot of that music is in commercials and is played all over the place. And you hear her voice, whether you realize it or not, in some of what you're listening to, from car commercials to all kinds of things. And even when it comes to others doing the Fleetwood Mac songs as cover tunes. We'll end on that note. Got a couple of great authors coming up next.
I'm Dan Pilla. I started fighting the IRS over 40 years ago when they tried to seize my mother's house. I sued the IRS and won. I beat the IRS then, and I've been beating them ever since. I wrote the book on tax debt settlement, and I've helped thousands of people deal with tax problems they thought might never be solved. I can help you too. If you owe taxes you can't pay, don't wait another day. There's no such thing as a hopeless tax case. Call 800-34-NO-TAX or go to my website, danpilla.com. That's danpilla.com, danpilla.com.
Frustrated trying to get business capital? Want to take the slow process and rejection out of the equation? GCNLoans.com removes the slow, irritating approval process. Instead, get quick, simple funding. Powered by David Allen Capital, 80% of our pre-qualified clients are approved in days. Pre-qualify at GCNLoans.com and get your money this week. It's that easy. GCNLoans.com. That's GCNLoans.com.
You are listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
USA Radio News.
I'm Tony Maruso reporting. A U.S. House of Representatives committee has obtained access to Donald Trump's tax returns following a years-long court fight with the Republican former president, who has accused a Democratic-led panel of being politically motivated. No word yet on whether the committee had yet accessed those documents. The U.S. House of Representatives on Wednesday voted to approve a bill to block a potentially crippling railroad strike and to mandate paid sick time for rail workers. Lawmakers voted 290 to 137 to impose a tentative contract deal reached in September on a dozen unions representing 115,000 workers after President Joe Biden warned of the catastrophic impact of a rail stoppage that could begin as early as December the 9th. This is USA Radio News.
Stop aging now. Restore those joints. Boost your strength. Because it's official. NutriMedical has released the most exciting, powerful anti-aging supplement on the market. Dr. Bill Deagle's Red Deer Velvet DR has been approved by the U.S. Patent Office. Imagine stem cell rejuvenation all in one capsule without huge expense. Dr. Bill MD discovered that as an unborn baby grows in the mother's womb, he or she does not deteriorate or physically age. Red Deer Velvet DR, like the uterus, provides 300 biomolecules and 6 hormones protected in one special DR capsule that delivers lipid packages directly into your circulation. This patented technology bypasses the stomach and is released into the small bowel unaltered by digestive enzymes and stomach acid. Remember, Red Deer Velvet DR. Improve endurance, stimulate your immune system, increase learning ability, and even improve sexual libido with Red Deer Velvet DR. Click NutriMedical.com. That's NutriMedical.com. Or call toll-free 888-212-8871 and get on the road to a newer, rejuvenated, happier you.
Do you need to get your hands on some extra money right now? Maybe $25,000 or more? If you're a homeowner, now is a perfect time to get cash out while homes in many neighborhoods like yours have gone up in value. You can use the money for anything. It's yours. You can buy an investment property, pay off higher interest debt, or make home improvements. If you need $25,000, $50,000, or more, now is the time. Home values are up, and so is your equity. We offer you a way to use it. No need to use your savings. Call New American Funding now and see how much cash out you can get. Call 800-721-2477. 800-721-2477. 800-721-2477. That's 800-721-2477. NMLS 6606. www.nmlsconsumeraccess.org. This is not an offer or commitment to lend. Subject to borrower and property qualifications. Not all borrowers will qualify. Terms and conditions apply. Equal housing opportunity.
Very pleased to take you to Scotland for a conversation with John Coyle. He's written a book called, and this book nails it, right? Outside the Nutshell, Success Versus Completion. And this is a guy who, check it out, in 2019, he was the IT, he had the IT project of the year in the UK. And as he told me off the air, that's the equivalent of my Emmy. He says, hey, you got an Emmy, but I got this. It equals the same thing. And truly it does when you think of the world that we live in. That's a high, high honor. And I think it's part of what is behind what makes John tick and why this book is so valuable, I think, to so many people if they could rearrange or reverse engineer the way they think. John, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you for having me, Kate.
So let's talk about the book and the road that led you to the book. What made you decide to write this book?
Well, it took a long time. I was actually asked to do a presentation at my work on projects and on deliveries. And then that grew into a seminar, which just maybe took a day. And then it actually made, it sowed a seed. And I actually realized I've got a lot of experience here. I've been working in this area for over 30 years. What experiences have I got? And I started jotting down some anecdotes, experiences, practices, things that went well, things that went wrong as well. Going wrong is a fantastic learning experience. I mean, it's not a nice experience. I wouldn't sort of wish it on you, but it certainly helps in many environments. I ended up with this massive information or knowledge, and I started, it then became a hobby. And I started rearranging, I had various different formats and presentations, but eventually it morphed into a book. And in doing the book, I actually realized that one of the things, one of the key things that I want to look at is how we move from a completion mentality to a success mentality. How do we generate success rather than a tick in the box and completing the tasks? And that's what I want to encourage people to do.
So in encouraging them, what are the things that they can do right now?
Right now, I think the thing that I really think is important is to step back and think. I say that a lot in the book. You know, to step back and think, why am I doing what I'm doing? Why do I do this? You know, what is the reason? You know, rather than just go through and say, I need to do A, B, and C, and tick, 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 say why? And start to understand better the reason that you're doing it, in some respects, capturing a bit more of the vision rather than just the practicalities. I've got an excerpt from the book that I think really, really helps. And it's one of the sections in the book that people have, you know, quote back to me. Say, oh, I really love your book and this bit. So I'll read it out. I was in Liverpool Street Station in London waiting for a train. It's a 4 p.m. train. As the departure time approached, the train details were on the board, but there was no platform. And just as the departure time, just as the clock hit 4 o'clock, the platform number appeared on the departure board, and I quickly made my way to the platform. But as I turned the corner and looked at the platform, the train was leaving. The train was actually leaving the platform, and it was empty. I complained to one of the staff, and was told that the train arrived in the platform in plenty of time, but it was 6 coaches long, and it was only leaving as a 3 carriages. So for health and safety reasons, and I totally agree with this, they're not allowed to have people on the platform when they decouple the train. But unfortunately, this was not completed until the departure time was imminent. The service level is measured on the trains leaving in a timely manner. So they uncoupled the train, announced the platform, and then the train left before any passengers could get to it. I was angry at the time, but on reflection afterwards, I realised that not only was this a ridiculous behaviour, but the train actually met the customer success criteria, which was it's on time. So I should have entered the month-end statistics as a success. And what I really want to try and get across is that completing the task, getting the train in, decoupling it, getting it on time, is not successful. It might look good, and it might be what you've been told to do, but you should be able to step back and think and say, why are we doing this? What's our vision for trains? And be able to say, right, okay, let's give it 5 minutes. Let everybody board and let the train go so people are, so we're meeting our customers where they are.
So your thinking, I think, is totally correct. But we live in a world where it is about completion. So how do we get people? I mean, your book is definitely chock full of all of this. How do you get people to get that mentality out of their minds that I just have to complete this project? I just have to get it done. Because I think even in school, we have homework. Get your homework done. Finish the homework. But am I learning what it is, or am I just, like you say, ticking the boxes? And isn't that what I learned to do as a child?
Yeah, well, I go back and, you know, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but it is about stepping back and thinking, you know, why am I doing this homework? You know, am I trying to tick the box for my child, or am I trying to actually get them to learn? So, you know, how can I help them learn? And look back in the book, I look at, you know, 2 different aspects. I look at the theory, how you identify your values, how you get a balance in what you're doing, how you utilize the skills that are available to you, not just your own skills, but those around you, and how you grow. So it's a bit of a theory of how you can grow. And then I look at the application of how you start a project, how you get it to stability, how you build on the stability, and then how you finish and exit. And I look across that a bit about what success and failure looks like. And the thing about it is, it's the starting that's most important. It's the starting of the project that really matters. It's understanding what you're trying to achieve, so that when you get into the project, you're not lost in the project and just looking at activities, you know, on a chart or a plan or a whatever, but you actually remember, why are we doing this? You know, I did win the Project of the Year award, and, you know, it's a project of the year, but it took me 4 years to get there. You know, it was a four-year project, and there was a lot of time and angst, and, you know, it was a team effort, and we laughed at it a lot about how, you know, all those meetings in those rooms that we thrashed things around and we put things up on the board, and several times we just took everything and we just wiped the slate clean and said, that's not going to work, let's start again, until we knew, until we felt confident that we were on the right track. So it is, and the other thing I think that's important, you know, it's about that completion and moving away from completion and to success. But I think one thing that is important is to scratch below the surface, you know, and dig a bit deeper. You know, ask yourself, Why am I doing what I'm doing? Is this information actually, am I understanding this properly? When my son was 2 years old, he was wearing a top with an orange sleeves, and he looked at one of the sleeves and pointed to it and said, "Orange." And, you know, for me, you know, taking that at face value, I'm saying, oh my goodness, this child is really clever. He knows his colours. And, you know, but he then pointed to the other sleeve and said, "Apple." And I realised he's got no connection with colours whatsoever. He's just, you know, and it's a bit scratching below that surface and saying, don't take everything at face value, because we're very, very, we're almost inclined to hear the information we want to hear. And you have to push back a bit and ask, well, am I understanding it right? Am I doing it right? Are you doing it right? Are we on the same? Are we engaging here rather than just passing information?
Do you think if people did that, they'd be more satisfied?
Oh, I think they would. I definitely think they would. I definitely think they would, because I think we find a lot of times, I think you've alluded to it as well, we get to the end of the task and we think, well, that's great, I've done it, but somebody's not happy. You know, we didn't meet this, and, you know, we feel we've done our job, but we get some negative feedback and you think, how did that happen? Because, you know, we haven't quite understood what they wanted. You know, we haven't quite got the full picture, or it hasn't quite been given to us in the first place. So I do think that people would be, I found it, I'm much more satisfied. You know, the more that I scratch below and I understand and encourage people to do it, the more satisfaction that I get from my activities.
Yeah. And I think you've said this, but really the takeaway is to stand back, is to look at what you're doing, whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's that standing back and asking the questions. You know, I think in a lot of relationships, you want to please. So when you tell me something, Kate, I want to give it yeah. You know, and you give it, John said yeah. But really what I should be doing is, Kate, see, when you said that to me, do you actually mean that you want me to do this, and this? And I should be able to repeat it back to you, and I should be able to think of scenarios. So say, when this happens, do I still do it? When that happens, should I do it this way? You know, and just to give it a 2-3 back and forward. Right. Have I understood that? Have I got that? So that I then, and then I come back and I'm doing what you want me to do, rather than, okay, you said do A, B, and C. And you give it, I know I said do A, B, and C, but, I mean, do you really think that was the right thing to do in that scenario? He says, well, that's what you said.
I think this book gives you people permission to, which I say is the power of questions, to ask questions.
Yeah, yeah.
Because then you don't get stuck in that scenario where you're not using even common sense. You're just going for the completion because, well, this is what you told me, even though I know this can't be right, because you don't know all the different scenarios. But if you ask more questions, you'd probably be well-armed in many cases.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And having also the confidence and the relationship to go back and knock your door. And I'm giving it, A, B, and C doesn't look very good, Kate. You know, so help me here. You know, do you still want me to do this? Because maybe it does. You know, I'm not sort of saying that you're, you know, but can I just double check? And then, you know, and that confidence to go back. Whereas if you're just passing out to 500 people, here's your success criteria. You have to do A, B, and C, trains on time. I've got no one to go back to.
Yeah, I totally agree. You can get the book Outside the Nutshell, Success Versus Completion, which we just talked about with the great John Coyle. You can get it on Amazon or wherever great books are sold. John, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kate. It's been a pleasure.
Those well-meaning friends who tell you what you ought to be doing with your life. I'm Kate Delaney. I have them. Occasionally I listened and I found myself stuck in dead-end jobs, relationships, and a life I absolutely did not recognize. In my book, Deal Your Own Destiny, I promise you, once you finish it, you won't let people tell you what to do anymore. Learn how to make bold moves that change the course of your destiny. The book is filled with stories that will make you laugh out loud and lessons you can apply right away. If you go to my website, KateDelaneyRadio.com. I have a steal of a deal. Check this out. Just $29.99 for both of my hard copy books. Deal Your Own Destiny, which I just talked about, and my girlfriend's gratitude journal. Perfect gift for girlfriends, wives, or any woman in your life. Again, both books, just $29.99. Click on special offer at katedelaneyradio.com.
Silver has always been nature's very own antibiotic, and only one system allows you to generate an endless supply of natural silver solutions. SilverLungs.com. You'll find no wild claims or pseudoscience, just a lifetime of nano-sized pure silver solutions. The Silver Lungs generator allows you to make your own, so stop paying for silver solutions. The unique lung delivery system targets respiratory infections where other silver solutions simply cannot reach. See the Silver Lungs generator and lung delivery system at SilverLungs.com. That's SilverLungs.com.
If you're concerned about the power grid and want to generate your own supply of off-grid electricity, this will be the most important message you'll hear this year. Here's why. We now have a small number of solar generators back in stock. These emergency backup systems provide life-saving backup power when you need it most. And unlike gas generators, solar generators run quietly, emit no dangerous fumes, and produce an endless supply of free electricity from the sun. Whether it's wildfires, dangerous weather, power grid issues, or just getting off the grid, you'll never have to suffer through painful power outages again. Even better, all this week, radio listeners get over $700 in free off-the-grid bonuses, too. Go to MySolarBackup.com to learn more and check availability. That's MySolarBackup.com. Look for the free report, Crisis Cooling, how to make absolutely sure your meat, milk, and medicines stay safe and cool in any power outage. Yours free at MySolarBackup.com.
What if you could cut your heating bills this winter with your existing wood-burning fireplace and not spend thousands doing it? You can with Great Wall of Fire Fireplace Grates. Our U.S.-patented, made-in-America Wall of Fire Grates increase fireplace efficiency, eliminate fireplace smoke problems, and come with a 30-day money-back guarantee. See our grates in action and get free shipping from walloffire.com or call 800-274-7364. Fireplace heat without fireplace smoke. Walloffire.com.
His book is incredible, Rising Black Quarterback, What It Means for America. I'm a big fan of his. When I started my career just outside of L.A., I read his stuff on the Dodgers at the Los Angeles Times. And then when he was with the Washington Post, he covered the then Redskins, which are now the Commanders. And you can catch his stuff on ESPN Now. He's the senior NFL writer and Scape, and of course he's been with ESPN, and you see him all over the place, and this book is really incredible. I read it from cover to cover. I learned some things I didn't know, and you're going to learn some amazing things too. So Jason, thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You know, Lamar Jackson, Pat Mahomes, Dak Prescott, there's a slew of quarterbacks. I'm from Philly, so I can't help it. I'm high on Jalen Hurts. I mean, I know it's really at the beginning of his career, so to speak, with the pros, but we saw what he did in college. It's a different story with the black quarterbacks now. Do you think they're getting, the black quarterbacks are getting the recognition they deserve?
Yeah, you know, I like to tell people now that there has never been a better time to be a black man who plays quarterback or aspires to play quarterback in the NFL. These guys are beloved by fans. They have the biggest contracts. Their platforms are enormous because of their success. And, you know, this has really been a journey more than 100 years in the making, because black quarterbacks or black men who aspire to play quarterback in professional sports, most successful league and professional sports, you know, most powerful league, were largely prohibited from doing it for most of the league's history. It really is a recent development. And by recent, I mean the mid to late 80s was when we really start to see black quarterbacks becoming okay, a part of the game, not considered an oddity or an outlier, that they really were, okay, people who were in the fabric of the NFL. So, yeah, a lot has changed, and we're at a point right now where, you know, in another 5 to 10 years, it would not be shocking if you saw as many as 12 to 16 superstar black quarterbacks. And by that, I mean, when you look at the college game now, you look at the traditional college powers, the Alabamas, the Ohio States, the USCs, all led by star black quarterbacks. You know, I'm a sports writer, and when I started my career, I was covering high school recruiting, and you would go to these elite high school recruiting camps for the quarterbacks, and you'd never see black faces. Now there are superstar 4- and 5-star recruits who are black quarterbacks all over the place. So we are in the era of the black quarterback now, and the pipeline from youth football to high school football to college football, it's just going to continue to flow to the NFL. And, you know, it really is something that when you talk about the evolution of the country, you know, in terms of many issues, you can see it in the NFL with the rise of the black quarterback.
And this is an obvious question, but why did it take so long for black quarterbacks to be accepted?
You know, I talk so much about this in my discussions about the book, and I try not to oversimplify it, but it really just comes down to racism. I mean, black men in the NFL, not just in the NFL, I mean, in America, were not considered to be smart enough, leaders, people who could inspire others. And by others, I mean, other, you know, white people. So, you know, if you look at that, if that's the way black men were looked at in society, clearly sports are just a, you know, microcosm of society. So that's the way they were going to be looked at in the NFL. And for decades, black players were not allowed to play the so-called thinking man's positions, center on the offensive line, because the center has to make line adjustments, middle linebacker on the defense, middle linebacker is a quarterback of the defense, or safety. The safety is the quarterback of the secondary. So if black players were not allowed to play those positions, clearly they wouldn't be allowed to play the ultimate thinking man's position, which is quarterback. So, you know, it really wasn't until these owners started to see that, okay, well, the game has gotten so big now that quarterback is truly the most important position. You can't overlook anyone at that position if you want to try to win. And it was really a matter of self-preservation for general managers and coaches, because once the game exploded, and, you know, when we get, you know, people forget that Major League Baseball really dwarfed the NFL for much of the previous century. But once you start getting into the 80s and the Super Bowl became this thing that occupied like all of America and the pageantry around it and the spectacle around it and these teams like, you know, the Bears and the 49ers and the Giants, like once the NFL going into the 80s really started to overtake Major League Baseball and the money got so big, these general managers and owners could not afford to just say, well, we're not going to take this quarterback because he's black. Because if you pass over somebody who can help you win and you lose your job, you're going to be like, I wish we'd have looked at that guy. So that's really the change that occurred.
Yeah. We're speaking with Jason Reed, and the book is Rise of the Black Quarterback, What It Means for America. I think that is such a big part of the title of this book. If you would, because we want people to go and get it, let's whet their appetite a little bit. Tell us a couple stories in the book.
You know, one story, a great one, is about Warren Moon, the only black quarterback enshrined in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Now, I suspect that's going to change in the years to come, but right now he's the only one in the Hall of Fame. And, you know, Warren Moon, he wasn't drafted into the NFL when he came out of, and it's so crazy when you think about it now. He was the what is now the Pacific 12 Conference. Back then it was called the Pac-8 Conference. He was the Pac-8 Conference co-player of the year, and he helped Washington win the Rose Bowl, the University of Washington, and he doesn't get drafted. I mean, that would never happen out of a major conference today, but he has to go to Canada, continue his career, goes to Canada, lights it up, wins championships, sets records passing. The then Houston Oilers win a bidding war to get Warren to come down from Canada. And after a transition period, he had a rough, first year, in making that transition, but after that transition, he lights it up. He becomes a perennial Pro Bowler. He sets, records. He gets into the Hall of Fame. And it's just so interesting how history might have been different, because the Dallas Cowboys, the elite scout of the Dallas Cowboys in their draft meeting, that 1978 draft, said, hey, this guy is a guy we should draft. But black men were not being drafted to play quarterback in the NFL in the late 60s and even to the late 70s. So, or at least not in high numbers in the late 70s. And Warren Moon got passed over. How might history have been different if Warren Moon had gone to Dallas and was the quarterback after Roger Staubach instead of Danny White? I mean, Dallas fans may want to think about that. Another story I would say, contemporary one, Patrick Mahomes. Just the clout he wields and how he uses his power to push the NFL to do things that he thinks it needs to do in terms of social justice issues. And, you know, he's very big in voting rights. And, you know, I was thinking about the fact that, you know, so many quarterbacks, he stands on the shoulders of so many quarterbacks before him who did not have the power to affect change. And the fact that he does, and the fact that he uses that power without, you know, concern about what it might do to his brand and people who might get upset about it, it says a lot about the rise of the black quarterback.
Yeah. And now finally moving from quarterback to, we see what's happening in the NFL, coaches, underrepresentation, obviously same thing in the GM ranks and front office ranks. And we see the Brian Flores lawsuit. What do you think it'll take for that to change?
Well, you know, I think people are just going to have to keep pushing. People internally in the NFL who believe that diversity and inclusion are good things from a business standpoint, those people have to keep pushing. Civil rights advocates externally, they have to keep pushing. Because, you know, clearly the hiring front is the next big front. It used to be that the biggest frontier in the NFL for black men was quarterback, getting to play the quarterback position. Now the frontier that has to be conquered and tamed, so to speak, is hiring at the executive level, in football operations and business operations, and on-field hiring with coaching in terms of head coaches. So I think that, you know, what we need to see is what we're seeing right now, but just in an ongoing basis, people continuing to push because this is the right thing to do.
Yeah. For you, last question, what was it like writing this book? Because I've said I'm a big fan. I've followed your career. You get sports. You've covered it for sports for a long time. I can imagine 70, 75 interviews, lots of conversations. So it might have been quite an undertaking. Was it fun?
It was fun. You know, it's so funny you mentioned the number. It was over 70 interviews, and it was done over about an 18-month period, researching, reporting, you know, writing. I've been a sports writer my whole career, you know, a beat writer and a columnist, and I always wanted to write a book, but from a timing standpoint, you know, then life gets in the way. You get married, you have kids, and a lot of things. But bottom line was, this is a book I had a lot of passion about. I was given time to write it, to report it, and write it in a way that I felt would do the subject matter justice. And I'm very proud of it. And I hope people will come to the book with an open mind and leave with maybe a new perspective on something that they thought they knew everything that there was to know about it.
Well said. Rise of the Black Quarterback, What It Means for America. Jason Reed, it's a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
My name is Milan Vukovic. 10 years ago, I got frustrated with the quality of Pau D'Arco tea sold in the stores. So, I founded the Pau D'Arco Tea Club that now ships our super tea to over 100 countries. You too can order or get info about the original pure Pau D'Arco super tea at www.drinksupertea.com or by calling 818-965-9113. Why settle for less when you can order original pure Pau D'Arco and drink super tea for only $34.95 per pound plus shipping? Each pound makes 300 cups, which is the equivalent of 12 cents per cup for the original pure Pau D'Arco super tea. Order now at www.drinksupertea.com. That's drinksupertea.com or by calling 818-965-9113. That's drinksupertea.com or by calling 818-965-9113.